find ourselves a good 2 weeks before Pesach, but as I'm sure everyone is finding out, it's never too early to get ready. So we devote this week and next week in Mitzvah Hashem to matters of Pesach, and as is our custom, we will begin with a discussion of Inyone Pesach, of one of the many, many halachic aspects, before we then turn our attention to the Haggadah. And there is a question that impacts many people in many ways, and that is the question of products that are not food in themselves, but they may contain chametz. They may be cosmetics, medicines, creams, soaps, and the likes. And it's very fascinating to trace the halacha's response to these questions from its roots. And as we'll see, not surprisingly, there may be more than one approach practically to the matter, but at least to gain an appreciation as to where things come from. So we begin at the beginning. Chametz and Pesach, as we know, it's important for to lay down the foundations, have them stated in an organized way. There are three issues with chametz. There are three separate prohibitions. Of course, it's also to eat it, ba'achila. It is also to get benefit from it. That means even if a person has a store that sells chametz, that he could not do. And it is also even to own it, and that makes chametz almost unique. There are a number of things in the Torah that it's forbidden to eat, and a few also that it's forbidden to get benefit from. But forbidden to own, that's quite rare. And that's a token of the stringency of the prohibition of chametz. Bali roi and bali motze. So we sell it, we do bittul, we destroy it, we do whatever we can. Okay. The matter begins in Maseches Psachim, in the third perek, in Daf Mem Hei Amud Beis. For there, the Gemara discusses as to whether it's ever possible for chametz to undergo a certain degeneration that would make it permissible to keep. Or is it anything that was once ever chametz, there's nothing that it could ever go through to make it acceptable to keep in one's possession. Now, this is a well-known halacha, and this is how it begins. Hapas she'ipsha, bread that went moldy, says the Gemara, if a person wouldn't eat it, wouldn't, couldn't, but a dog still could, it needs to be destroyed, which is interesting. Because, as we know, and this is the metric for the ability to maintain chametz, what's called nifsal me'achilas kelev. Even a dog wouldn't eat it. That itself still needs to be quantified, after all. Depends on the nature of the dog. How hungry is he? How desperate is he? Where does he live? And what does he normally eat? There are even discussions amongst the poskim. I heard reported that Rav Moshe Feinstein said that a dog in America would turn his nose away at certain things that dogs in Europe would eat. And that's not hard to believe. So when still, when we talk about nifsal me'achilas kelev, it's down to the nature of the beast as well. However, assuming that we will be talking about things that l'choladeus, they will be globally considered nifsal me'achilas kelev, this is where it comes from. It's an inference from the fact that the Talmud says that if a person would still eat it, would not eat it, but a dog would still eat it, it has to be destroyed. The inference is that if even a dog wouldn't eat it, then you can keep it. Then it doesn't have to be destroyed. And that inference is made by the Rif. What's interesting is, this is a very extreme level of degeneration, of spoiling that needs to be gone through in order to be considered permitted. Way in excess of our general halachic experience. It happens to be that of the rule of thumb when it comes to these things is if as soon as a person couldn't eat it, if it becomes unfit for human consumption, it is already considered to have exited from its prohibited status. But when it comes to chametz, it's not enough that a human wouldn't eat it. It needs to reach a stage that a dog wouldn't eat it. And the question is, if we ask, ma nishtana, ha isur hazeh mikol ha isur, why should chametz be any different? And the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, explains that the problem with chametz is twofold. Not only, in order to qualify as chametz, not only does it have to be the foodstuff that we would call chametz, but we see that something is considered chametz even if it maintains the capability of making something else chametz. Because if you put chametz into the mix, it can cause leavening in whatever it's mixed in with. And in fact, evidence of this is that the Torah forbids to own yeast. Now, yeast in its pure form is not really food. But when it comes to Pesach, you have to get rid of it. And you can't eat it. Well, why not? It's not food. But of course, yeast has the classic property of being able to render something else chametz. And therefore, says the Ran, this is what is behind the most unusual situation when it comes to chametz. It's not enough that it's no longer considered to be human food. It has to have lost its capacity to be able to make something else into chametz. And that is only true when it is so spoiled that even a dog wouldn't eat it. Now, thus far, if we're careful in our phraseology, we should note that the Talmud has only spoken and inferred with regards to keeping it in your possession. But the question is, but can I use it? And here we turn to the sister statement of the Gemara here, which is earlier on in the beginning of the second perek, in Daf Kaf Aleph Amud Beis. And that is a statement of Rava. Rava says, these are his words, charocho kodem zmano. If you scorched chametz before the time that it becomes forbidden, which for us is the sixth hour, at the final hour of the morning, if you scorched it before that time, mutar bahana oso, afilu la'achar zman isur, it is mutar to get benefit from it even after the time of the prohibitions of chametz accrue. And the Rishonim, of course, explained that when we talk about scorching it, that doesn't mean making toast. Scorching it means it's been scorched to the degree, once again, that a dog would look the other way. Nifsa mi'achilas kelef, that's the standard that's been set. But what we do discover from this Gemara, that we had never seen stated explicitly before, is that when it's reached the point, or crossed the threshold of nifsa mi'achilas kelef, not only can you own it, but you can also use it. For whatever you'd want to use it for. It is no longer forbidden for benefit. And now, if you pardon the expression, the burning question is, can you eat it? And here, although it's a machlokus rishonim, the Rosh says, ad kan. Even if it's been spoiled, and therefore we would say it's ois chametz. This is not chametz. You can keep it like you can keep anything else in your house. You can use it like you can use anything else in your house, but you can't eat it. Now, of course, why would you want to eat it if it's already nifsa mi'achilas kelev? There's one in every family. But the question is, could you eat it? And the answer is no. That's interesting. It somehow retained a vestige of its chametz status that you can't eat it, even if you want to. And this brings us to one of the most important terms when we discuss chametz, spoiled chametz in products, and that is the term achshevei. Achshevei, from the word chashuv, lachshiv, that means that you have given it significance. By choosing to eat it, you have bestowed upon it and reinvested it within it the status of food. That's your decision. Achshevei. You relate to it as food, it carries back the prohibition of food, and of course the food in question is chametz, and it's Asur on Pesach. So you can keep it, and you can use it, but you can't eat it. And this is the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, here we need to proceed very carefully, Because on the one hand, if we had to give a one-word answer, you know, spoiled chametz, can you eat it? The answer is no. But it's not enough to give a one-word answer, because the reasoning is critical. The reason why you can't eat it is because the act of eating bestows upon it the status of food, and then you can't eat it anymore. But that reasoning needs to accompany us as we discuss all of these questions. And let us see a fascinating example of how the guiding force of achshavei, of investing it with importance, determines everything. The Trumas Hadeshen, fascinating tshuva of Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, the great Trumas Hadeshen, was asked with regards to ink, that part of the process of the ink was that it was boiled up together with beer made from barley, which of course is complete chametz. And that's how they used to make ink in those days. And people say they had a story brewing. I think this is where it comes from. So it's cooked together with chametz, but of course we would all agree by the time it, and he mentions some of the ingredients, and they are awful. That means the whole thing is certainly nifsa me'achilas kelev. It would be considered spoiled. No dog would eat it. Absolutely. So, can you write with it? Now, the Trumas Hadeshen says you can. Of course, not going into the details of what you're allowed to write on Chol HaMoed Pesach anyway, but there are certain things that you can, and you can use that ink. And the reason why, so far, makes perfect sense. After all, it's spoiled, completely spoiled, nifsa me'achilas kelev, and therefore you can own it, and you can use it. So why is this even a topic for discussion? The reason why, says the Trumas Hadeshen, is because it was the practice of scribes and people, as they wrote with the ink, they wrote with the quill. Sometimes the ink would dry a little bit, and they would put the tip of the quill in their mouth just to add a bit of moisture and then carry on writing. Now, if your ink is not kosher, you can't put it in your mouth. And of course, let us remind ourselves that we draw the line when it comes to even chametz that's spoiled. You can own it, and you can use it, but you can't eat it. So should this be a problem to use the ink in the normal way? And the Trumas Hadeshen says, there is no problem. And to hear why is fascinating. But of course, for us, with our build-up, it will make perfect sense. The reason why is because, remember, this isn't chametz. It's been spoiled. Nifsa me'achilas kelev. You can own it, you can use it. It is true that you can't eat it, but remember, the reason why you can't eat it is not because it's treif. You can't eat it because the act of eating revives it, so to speak. The act of eating invests it with a certain status of food. In order to do that, you need to put it in your mouth as an exercise in eating. But if you're just looking to add some moisture to the quill, that's not called eating. It's true as far as the laws of chemistry are concerned. Some of it will remain in your mouth. Quite true. If it tasted of mint, you taste the mint afterwards. True. But the whole exercise has nothing of the act of eating about it. And therefore, achshavei is not invoked. And there has been no eating here. If it was treif, you couldn't do that. But it's not treif. And you have not given it the status of food by once in a while just touching it to the tip of your tongue or something like that. And that's a very interesting example of this concept in motion. And the truth is that there are those who take this principle and will apply it instantly to the question of medicines in our time. There are a number of medicines and they contain chametz. Now, if the medicines have a sweet taste, so then certainly it is a definite problem because it's not nifsal at all. But we're talking about pills and capsules and things like that that are tasteless at best and generally bitter tasting. And if that's true, then certainly we'd be inclined to consider any chametz within them as nifsal me'achilas kelev. Now what will we say? That's true, but you're eating it. I mean, you are making a point of putting it in your mouth and swallowing it. Will we say achshavei? And Rav Moshe Feinstein says, no. In other words, based on the principle that achshavei comes from the act of eating. So the chiddush of Rav Moshe in the Igros Moshe is that it's only considered achshavei, it's only an act of eating if you relate to it as food. You're eating it for nutritional or the reasons why people normally eat food. But when people take medicine, it's not an act of eating. It's not because they're hungry, and they don't relate to the medicine as people would relate to food. And therefore, the entire endeavor, the entire transaction that is called taking medicine, although you do with the pill exactly more or less what you would do with any other food, but ingesting medicine for purely medicinal purposes does not bring you to that problematic area that's called achshavei. And the proof being, says Rav Moshe, people will eat, quote unquote, they will ingest things for the sake of refuah that never were food and would never be considered by any reckoning to be food, but they happen to have healing properties, medicinal properties. And therefore, categorically, according to Rav Moshe, taking a pill for the sake of refuah would not bring you to the problematic area of achshavei if the chometz inside has been spoiled and bitter-tasting medicines, it has been spoiled to that significant degree, it is mutter. That's Rav Moshe's position. Now what's interesting is, a slightly modified version of this is to be found in the writings of the Chazon Ish. Because the Chazon Ish, it seems, is not prepared to say that as soon as you're only taking this for the sake of refuah and not as food, that's not called eating. He's not prepared to say that. But what he does say is that as a general rule, the presence of the chometz, or the ex-chometz, within the medicine is not really medicinal. In other words, it may be there to hold the medicine together or to give it body or for any accessory reason or auxiliary reason, but it's not the medicine itself. And that being the case, says the Chazon Ish, even if a person, we relate to the pill as an act of eating, that may well be, but the chometz within the pill is not what he's considered to be eating. He hasn't given it the status of food because that's not really what his intention is to eat at all. It's only serving the medicine that he is taking. And that is the general role that chometz or spoiled chometz will play within medicines as a binding agent or the like. And this approach, which again leads us to the point of leniency, is quoted by Rav Waldenberg in the Tzitz Eliezer and Chelek Yud. And so far, everyone has, in a sense, said that it's mutter. Rav Waldenberg interestingly concludes and says, it is mutter. Aval, Yisrael Kedoshim Hei, the holy Jewish people, when it comes to Pesach, there is an accepted practice that if it is all possible, with no negative ramifications or risk of any complications, to shift to a substitute that is kosher le Pesach, then that is what good Jews do, and it's a commendable practice. Once again, cannot be emphasized enough, assuming that there is no risk that the shift will have in any way suffer in terms of the positive effect. But this is a hidur, and of course, when do we have hidurim if not Pesach? As much as from the strict letter of the law, it is mutter, but if one can find, even to be prescribed closer to the time from the outset with a kosher Pesach substitute, and that's where all the lists come in, and that's a very good practice, but if it's unavailable, or it's not going to be the same thing, then the answer is mutter. Now, we find ourselves at an interesting juncture, because it turns out that if you eat the spoiled chometz as part of medicine, that's essentially okay anyway. And some people are machmir. But if you're not eating it, but rather you're using it in any other way, so then that's not eating, and it's fine if the chometz has been spoiled. However, there is a most interesting factor that now enters into the discussion. And it relates to a concept which is called sicha. Now, sicha literally means anointing, which for us doesn't mean anything. Practically, it means rubbing something into your skin. And the Mishnah tells us in the ninth parak of Maseches Shabbos, the words of Rabbi Akiva, that anointing, sicha, rubbing oil into your skin, is the halachic equivalent of drinking. Sicha kishtiyah. In other words, getting something into your system via the skin is considered to be a parallel effect to getting it into your system by drinking it. And he quotes a pasuk from Tehillim, Vatavo kamayim bekirbo ucheshemen be'atzmosav. The pasuk draws an equation between drinking water and your system absorbing oil. Now, if that's the case, then we may have a problem again. Because we have said that spoiled chametz is acceptable for any benefit except for eating and drinking. But all of a sudden, applying it to your skin is considered to be the halachic equivalent of drinking. So are we back again to the problem of achshavei? So here we should note firstly that the Tosfos maintained this equation, this very unusual equation of smearing or rubbing something into your skin with drinking, is a din derabbanan, it's a chumrah derabbanan, as is evidenced by the fact that even on Yom Kippur, when one is not allowed to, that's one of the things that's the inuyim, the afflictions, right? Not to rub oil into your skin. But the Gemara says that if a person has scabs or something like that, that for medicinal reasons, for therapeutic reasons, he needs to rub oil into his skin, it's permissible, even on Yom Kippur. Says the Tosfos, that would not be true if it was Torah law. In other words, that constitutes tsa'ar, discomfort. Torah law is not set aside in a case of discomfort. The rabbis will set their laws sometimes aside in case of discomfort. And therefore, the fact that the halacha is that if a person is in a state of discomfort, sicha becomes mutter, that is evidence of the fact that this idea that sicha is like drinking is a din drabbanan, which of course makes a very big difference. But moreover, the critical point as far as Tosfos is concerned is that Tosfos tell us that this concept of sicha kishtia, rubbing is like drinking, only appears twice in the entire Talmud, with regards to Yom Kippur and with regards to truma, oil of truma. If you're a non-Kohen, you can't drink truma and you can't rub the oil of truma into your skin either. And the emphatic point of Tosfos is, and this they maintain halachically, that the entire concept of sicha kishtia only exists within those two cases. There is no concept of sicha kishtia outside of Yom Kippur and outside of truma. And that seems to be the position that is adopted by most authorities, certainly by the Ramah. How does it come out? For the Ramah discusses using soaps that were made from non-kosher ingredients in Hilchos Shabbos. And the Ramah says, those types of soaps, and he describes all of them, and some of them have non-kosher ingredients, the Ramah says, don't use it on Shabbos, because soap and Shabbos is problematic. As we know, there's a number of problems. Could be nolad and could be other things. But what's amazing is the inference of the Ramah by saying that you can't use soap, some of which has non-kosher ingredients, on Shabbos, is that during the week, it's no problem. Now, eating not kosher is forbidden during the week as well, not only on Shabbos. And therefore, we see from the Ramah that he seems to have taken the position of Tosfos as definitive, that this entire concept of putting something into your skin is like drinking, that is, was said in Yom Kippur and Truma, but it only is true in those two cases. It doesn't exist anywhere else, not with non-kosher ingredients, and therefore, for purposes of our discussion, not with regards to chametz on Pesach. And if that is the case, then one would need, in a sense, to make a very strong case in order to be machmir with regards to creams and soaps and shampoo and all those sorts of things, because you would need to say, not only am I using the chiddush of achshavei, that even though it's spoiled by eating it, I've given it status, but I'm making now a shidduch between that idea and the idea that putting something into my skin is like drinking, And even though the Tosa said that's not true outside of Truma and Yom Kippur, but I'm subscribing to the opinions that it applies everywhere. So in a sense, it is a double chumrah, right? One on top of the other. And it is for that reason that the overwhelming consensus is that those creams and the like can be used without a problem. If a person wants to be machmir, certainly they can. If it's for medicinal purposes, a medicinal cream or the like, so that is instantly acceptable. Because even on Yom Kippur, when sicha is explicitly forbidden, but in the case of discomfort, it's mutter. And therefore, certainly for ex-chometz on Pesach, it would be mutter. And what's more, there are those who say that the entire concept of sicha is almost a foreign concept for us, this idea of anointing oils. It's really like a pleasure pursuit. But much of what we use in terms of soap and shampoo and that is for hygiene. And that would perhaps fit more into the medicinal realm than into the sicha for pleasure realm. And therefore, for that reason as well, it would be considered acceptable. And therefore, we revert to the default position that the only problem with spoiled chametz, if there is a problem, would be with medicines that are ingested. And there again, if there's an alternative, to go for it. Otherwise, no. One final point that deserves a very interesting mention here in terms of chametz that is spoiled are perfumes and colognes and the like. Some of which could contain chametz, because if the alcohol is grain-based, they could be chametz. Now, in a sense, the question is, well, why is this different than anything else? We've gotten past all the barriers, it's applied to the skin, but that's okay. Except the point is that with regards to these substances, although in principle they are nifsa mechilas kelev, okay, no one drinks them, although sometimes it seems to be the only way to account for how quickly the bottle empties, but no one drinks them. Why should there be a question? Says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank in the Mikrei Kodesh, the reason why there's a question is because the alcohol in them itself is chametz, it's chametz derivative, but it's mixed with other things that make it undrinkable. Yes, it is. But it can be gotten back. It can be reclaimed. Through various diluting and chemical treatments, it is possible to re-extract the offending alcohol and make it drinkable again. And this is not just theory. People did this. And people who were desperate enough for alcohol and had nothing else, they had various ways. It's amazing. They had no money, but they had the technology to do this. And it was a practice, and Rav Moshe speaks about it as well. Among the lower classes, they were able to extract the alcohol and, in a sense, rejuvenate it back to chometz alcohol. So it's a most fascinating question as to chometz that's been spoiled completely, but contains within it the possibility of being unspoiled. Does that then change its status? It could be reinstated. And it's for this reason, in case, because it's quite well known that there are certain people in their mechiras chametz, they include their perfumes and the like. This is why. In principle, it's nifsa me'achilas kelev. But because of this issue that the alcohol could be extracted and that would be chametz yet again, it is treated with more discretion and put away. So these are some of the highlights of the very interesting question. Of course, there's many, many details. What is the role of the chametz? How is it mixed in? Etc., etc. But these are, in a sense, the Rosh HaProkim of this very interesting discussion that affects every home before Pesach in any number of ways. So now, mitoch devar halacha, let us come to discuss one or two items of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The first thing I would like to discuss is a topic of general interest with regards to the Haggadah, and that is the very loud absence of the most significant personality, who for us is always wrapped up with the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim, and that is Moshe Rabbeinu. He's not mentioned anywhere in the Haggadah. Actually, that's not true. He's mentioned once in a passing mention. a passing reference. With one of the proof texts, we'll bring him in, Vayaminu Bashem uva Moshe Avdo, and that was an accident. In other words, he is conspicuously absent. And the question is, why is that? What's most fascinating is Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the one of the sons of Rav Chaim, he was the father of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So he understands that this matter itself is reflected in the Medrash, Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, Perek Gimel, begins with the words, Al Mishkavi Balelos, as I'm lying at night, Bikashti Eish She'ahava Nafshi, so I sought after the one whom I love, Bikashti V'lo Mitzosiv, I sought him and didn't find him. And the Medrash Shir HaShirim says, Al Mishkavi Balelos, Ze Leil Mitzrayim. Mishkavi Balelos. It's the night of Pesach when everyone reclines. That's the night when everyone is lying down. Bikashti, Eish She'ahava Nafshi, I sought after the one who I love, Moshe Rabbeinu. He is the hero of the story. And we're looking for him. Bikashtiv v'lo mitzosiv. And we can't find him. And what is behind it? Explanations. But the Vilna Gaon says something which is quite delicate. And that is that the nature of Seder night is a celebration of Geula, of the Jewish people, of our redemption. And at a certain point, it becomes critical to take Moshe out of the picture. And the reason why is because the birth of the Jewish people is the birth of God's people. And therefore, when it comes to an appreciation of Moshe's role as the Shaliach, all well and good. But when it comes to forging the bonds of the Jewish people with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there can be no misunderstanding that Moshe was anything more than an executive for the Geula, but never to relate to him as the essential source of the Geula, to the extent that religious allegiance is owing to him and not to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, as we read the Parshiyos, so Moshe's there the whole time. But in terms of the goal of Seder night, so Moshe's name is left out. It's very interesting. But what's more interesting is this, I believe, will explain to us the words of the Rambam. For in Perek Zayin Halacha Beis of Hilchos Chametz Matzah, the Rambam says, Lefidato shelben oviv melamdo. One always has to tailor the answers on the Seder night to the intellectual level of the child. As much as there are stock answers in the Haggadah, they are, in a sense, templates on which to build. But if you just say them to your child, and they're, he needs to hear more, or maybe less. So we have Keneged Abonim Divrei Torah, but you need also to use your initiative. And that's what the Rambam says. Lefidato shel ben, this is actually from the Mishnah in Pesachim, depending on the das of the child, oviv melamdo, ketzad, and Rambam gives examples. Im hayakotel otipesh, let's say he's a young child, or he's on the lower side of the intellectual food chain. Omelo, bini, you say to him, kulano hayinu avodim, you tell him the story in a very simple way, we were all avodim, kemo shivchazo, like if he knows any avodim, he should say, you know, like there, he's an eved, that's how we were. Okay, living example, b'mitzrayim, uvalayla hazeh, poda osana kadosh baruch hu v'yotzienu l'cheiros. As simple as can be, to tell him the story, no frills. Says Rambam, v'im haya haben godol, o chacham. But when he's older, and smarter, modio mashi'iro lana b'mitzrayim, you tell him more, tell him what happened in Mitzrayim, v'nisim she'na'asu lanu ayidei Moshe Rabbeinu, hakol lefidato shelben. So that's very interesting, because whereas the Haggadah makes no mention of Moshe, the Rambam does, but he makes a point of bringing in the reference to Moshe with the answer to a ben chacham. So the question is, well, the Haggadah seems to have, you know, fought so hard to keep him out, and the Rambam brings him in. So how do we resolve this situation? But the answer, based on the Vilna Gaon, I think is very clear. Moshe Rabbeinu's name is not in the Haggadah because the Haggadah represents the lowest common denominator of Sifrei Yetzias Mitzrayim. That is to say, it's what everyone needs to know. It is vital information for the story. The role of Moshe Rabbeinu is much more delicate because to appreciate him as a shaliach is one thing, but perhaps to misapprehend his role and ascribe to it more of an obeisance, so that would be worth more damage than good it would do. And therefore, I think it's very appropriate that the Rambam's mentioning of Moshe Rabbeinu is in the Tshuva to the Ben Chacham. Because if he's a Ben Chacham, then he's wise enough to appreciate and have a depth of perspective as to understanding the role of Moshe without compromising what Seder night is all about. And thus did Moshe Rabbeinu's name find his way into the answer of the Ben Chacham. Now, another very interesting feature of Maggid, again a general comment, is that it is a mitzvah. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs, and it's based on the pasuk V'igadat Levincha. It is a positive commandment. Positive commandments are generally preceded by brachos. And in fact, that's why many people, or perhaps are unaware, that it's actually a Torah mitzvah to tell the story, because normally there's a marker. If you give me a bracha, I know I'm about to do a mitzvah. There should have been a bracha. Lesaper Yetzias Mitzrayim, or fill in the ending, but there should be a bracha. And it's missing. And it's not because we're in a hurry, we understand. So where did the bracha go? Now, there are certain mefarshim who respond and tell us that that's not entirely true. It's not entirely accurate that there is no bracha accompanying Sibur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Actually, there is a bracha, because Magid ends with a bracha. Ka'al Yisrael? Quite true. Says Rav Shlomo Kluger, I'm not happy about that. And the reason why is because there are mitzvahs that you make a bracha beforehand and afterwards. There is such a thing. Hallel. Correct. But where do you ever find a bracha a mitzvah that the bracha only comes at the end and not at the beginning? So in a sense, we haven't answered the question, we've just given impetus to restate it. The question is no longer why is there no bracha on Magid, but why is it not in its normal place? Why does it come at the end and not at the beginning, where all brachas should be? And Shlomo Kluger says something which I think is so profound, because it takes us into the atmosphere of Seder night. We have a principle that guides us through the evening. It is called Maschilim Bignus U'Mesayimim B'Shevach. We begin with difficulties and we end with the positive. Why do we have to begin with difficulties? Why not just make the whole evening positive? Says Maharal, the reason why is because Seder night, first and foremost, is a night of appreciation. And human nature being what it is, appreciation is the product of contrast, not of continuity. That is to say, you appreciate something when you didn't have it before, but if you have it the whole time, you become desensitized and take it for granted. And therefore, in order to appreciate something, and you appreciate when it's warm, if you came in either from the blistering cold or the heat. But if it was always warm, so then what's to appreciate? On Seder night, in order to fully appreciate Yetzias Mitzrayim, we need at least to consider what it was like to be there. And that contrast will bring out the appreciation. Interestingly, and I heard this from my father, Zechon Levracha, many years ago, in the name of the Orachaim HaKadosh, this vector of beginning with difficult times and then ending with the positive is actually embedded in the source of the mitzvah. For the mitzvah is v'higadata levincha bayomahu leimor. Now there's two verbs there. Hagada, v'higadata, and amira, leimor. Now Rashi in Parshas Yisro will tell us that the difference between these two terms is that Haggadah always has a connotation of something which is harsh. V'sageid levnei Yisrael, koshim kegidim, things that are tough. Amira is amira raka, kotomer leves Yaakov. And therefore, in a sense, there's a certain direction being set. You begin with vihigadata, you begin with difficult things, with the goal of ending lemor with the amira, umesayim in basheva. And now, there is a halacha. In Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah, you know, there's twice in the year that we read the Tochacha, and as we know, the Tochacha is quite long, but we don't break it up in the middle. And that's the Gemara says. And there's a couple of reasons why. But one of the reasons is, Lefi She'ein Mevarchin Al Peronos, because we do not make disaster, certainly not, we do not make a bracha on disaster, certainly not communal disaster. It's not just that you don't wish to offend whoever it was that got the aliyah for the middle of the Tochacha. It's because it is not appropriate to make a bracha on Peronos. Why not? Well, the Tosfos say, there is a concept in the Pasuk, we say in Tehillim, Imo Anochi Betzara. That means when the Jewish people are Betzar, so the Shekhinah is Betzar. And therefore when you describe a situation of Tzar, a potential Tzar, the Tochacha, so it's not appropriate at that time to give brachas to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So say the Tosfos. And therefore, says Reb Shlomo Kluger, if we really wish to fulfill the mitzvah of Magid correctly, we should find ourselves unable to make a bracha, by definition, at the beginning of the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah begins bitzar. The mitzvah begins bignus. As soon as you set foot into the mitzvah of Magid, you are in exile in Mitzrayim. And imo anochi v'tzara. If you know how the mitzvah works, you should understand that at that opening stage of the mitzvah, the Jewish people are bitzar, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is bitzar. And therefore we don't make a bracha. The goal of the mitzvah is mesayim b'shevach, to reach a point of redemption whereby at the time of the geula, it is finally appropriate to make a bracha. So I believe there is a most profound message which is communicated by the absence of that bracha in the beginning of Magid. If you understand how Magid begins, a bracha is most inappropriate. Maschilim bignus. When we get to Shevach, that's when the brachas will come. Now let's take a look at the nusach of the Haggadah itself. We begin, of course, with Holach Ma'anya. If anyone has a fighting chance of saying something at the Seder, it's going to be at Holach Ma'anya. And we say, Holach Ma'anya di'achol avasonet ba'ar de Mitzrayim. We talk about the matzah. And then we say, Kol dichven yesev yechol. Anyone who's hungry, let them come and eat. Kol ditzrich yesev yesach. Anyone who's needy, let them come and make Pesach with us. There is much discussion, we ourselves have discussed in the past, exactly whether this is an honest-to-goodness invitation now, or perhaps it is a reflection of the Hachnosas Orchim spirit of Pesach. The real invitation will take place in Shul, half an hour prior to this. Because if you wait till you come home and shut your door and make Kiddush and then invite whoever is needy, they will have to have followed you home in order to respond. But nonetheless, it reflects, and nowhere is the greater Hachnosas Orchim than Leil HaSeder. It reflects the fact that everyone is welcome. But we have two expressions. And if we're medaktik in the nusach of the Haggadah, so we'll be vastly rewarded. Kodich v'nyeseh v'yechol. Whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. Kodich v'nyeseh v'yechol. It seems to be largely two ways of saying the same thing. Rav Elva Soloveitchik explains that actually these two expressions, Kol dich v'nyeseh v'yechol, and kol ditzrich yeseh v'yifsach, correspond to the two primary mitzvahs in principle of the night of Pesach. They are matzah and korban Pesach. Times where, as they should be, matzah and korban Pesach. And what's fascinating about them is that they are divided in the following way. Ideally, a person should be hungry by the time they get to matzah. Practically, they are anyway. But the halacha safeguards it. Arvei Pesachim, that's how the 10th parak of Pesachim begins. On Erev Pesach, somach lemincha, for a couple of hours beforehand, a person doesn't eat foods that are filling, in order that he should eat matzah l'te'ovon, with a good appetite. It's considered hidur mitzvah. So your ideal state as you come to eat matzah is you should be hungry. That's not true for Korban Pesach. Actually, the opposite is true. For the ideal state to which to fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach is called Al Hasova. Al Hasova means you've already eaten something, you're not very hungry anymore, you're not full, and just the last thing that you eat that evening is the Korban Pesach. And you have an appetite, but you're not hungry. That's called Al Hasova. And therefore, says Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, these two aspects of the Seder night are what are being referred to respectively with these two phrases. First we say, kol dichvid, and kofan means hungry. Kafna, actually in Aramaic, means famine. Kol dichvin yese v'yecho means whoever is very hungry, which everyone is at that time, yese v'yecho, let them come and eat. Perfect! That's how you should be hungry when you eat matzah. Kol ditzrich, by the time you come to eat the Korban Pesach, you shouldn't be that hungry anymore, but you should still be tzarech, that you would still need to eat a little bit more, but not hungry anymore. That's the ideal state of Al Hasova, kol ditzrich yese v'yitzach. So, the more we see the precision of the terminology of the Haggadah, the more we appreciate. And while we're talking about dual phraseologies, so let us see how Halach Ma'anya concludes. Because I came across a comment of the Vilna Gaon, and I believe it is a must. How do we conclude? Hashata hocha l'shana ba ba'arad Yisrael. Very nice. This year here, next year in Eretz Yisrael. Hashata avde l'shana ba b'nei chorin. This year slaves, next year free. Okay. As we know. Once again, from a bird's eye point of view, it seems largely two ways of saying the same thing. I mean, where will we be free if not in Israel? Hashata itzim, this year here, next year there. This year slaves, next year free. And the Vilna Gaon says, Perush, it means as follows. Dichtiv, he quotes a pasuk from the Novi Yeshaya, Perek Aleph, the end of the Haftarah for Shabbos Chazon. Tzion b'mishpat tipadeh v'shaveh ha-bitzdaka. Now, okay, what does this pasuk tell us? It talks about the redemption of two entities. One is called Tzion, and one is called the people that come back to Tzion. Tzion b'mishpat tipadeh v'shaveha b'tzdaka. Now, what's amazing about the Gaon is that these are not just two things mentioned one after the other. They are two things that will happen one after the other. Meaning, kolomar, b'tchila tipadeh Tzion. First, Tzion will be redeemed. Ve'achar kach v'shaveha. And then the people that come back to it will be redeemed. It's a progression. It is a sequential pasuk. Lakach omar betchila. And that is why the end of Halach Ma'anya refer to these two things. How so? First we say, Hashata hocha, this you hear, l'shana ba, B'Yerushalayim, right? B'Shana Ba Ba'arid Yisrael. Hu Ge'ula L'Yerushalayim. That's the Ge'ula for Yerushalayim. In other words, that there will be Jewish people there. That's stage one. But what's amazing is, that does not automatically lead to the freedom of the people who are there. Va'achar zeh L'Shana Haba B'nei Chorin Hu Ge'ula L'Yisrael. In other words, the first thing we say is L'shana ba ba'arad Yisrael, but says the Gaon, getting to Israel is one thing. Getting to Israel is an element of reclaiming the land. But the redemption of the Jewish people is a stage that is not simultaneous with that. You can have a situation of the Jewish people in Israel, and they're still not B'nai Chorin. And that's why we wish for two things. The Shana Ba Ba'arad Yisrael, but not only Ba'arad Yisrael. The Shana Ba B'nei Chorin. And I think these words of the Gaon, they don't need any commentary explanation. They could mean so many things. But they ring true for all the ways that we understand that even as the Jewish people are back to a large degree in Eretz Yisrael, but they're not B'nei Chorin. Whether whatever resolution of the wicked is that's condemning them and restricting them, and the Gaon who sent his Talmid into Eretz Yisrael, for Tzion B'mishpat Tipader, is telling us that there is yet a step to be taken. And therefore, I think it gives added meaning for all of us when we say Lashon HaBa Ba'arad Yisrael is a stage before Lashon HaBa B'nei Chorin. That has many emanations that surround us constantly. Now, from here, let's move to the two sons. And there's an understanding of the question of the Chacham. Normally we make a beeline for the Rosha, but the Chacham also deserves some credit. Shouldn't lose out just for being a Chacham. And his question is, as we know, Maha'edos, Vachukim, Vamishpatim, Mashatziv, Hashem Elokeinu Eschem. Okay. On the one hand, of course, we ask, well, you know, if he's such a Chacham, how come he doesn't know? Right? But apparently, there's something very wise about his question. And the answer is, we tell him, Kirchasa Pesach, Eimaptir Nachar Pesach Afikoman. And there is an interpretation of his question that is to be found again in the writings of Rabbi Velvel Soloveitchik that opens it up for us. We look at these terms, Eidus, Chukim, and Mishpatim, and they're largely the same, different ways of saying the same thing. They're all mitzvahs at the end of the day. But of course, Eidus is testimony. Chukim and Mishpatim are statutes and laws. And what is the depth of the question of the Chacham? He's actually asking something very interesting. You see, there are certain mitzvahs that you perform an act, and the act has a certain symbolism behind it. And it tells a story. We sit in sukkahs, that's an act. Because it represents something. It represents an awareness of something. There are other mitzvahs that we tell the story. Like we tell the story of Amalek. That's a mitzvah of Zachor. And interestingly, on Seder night, it's important just to be aware that sometimes the two exist separately to appreciate that on Seder night they come together. We take it for granted because we do it every year. But when you think about it, Seder night has a night of telling a story. So if you tell the story, so you're done. Everybody knows. So if you only had the mitzvahs of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, so then the question would be, which is a good question, so why do we eat Pesach, why do we eat Matzah, why do we eat Maror? And then from that, the story will come out. So through those mitzvahs, the message will be communicated. Alternatively, if you tell the story, you've communicated the message. And on Seder night, we do both. We tell the story, and then we eat all these things, which seem to be two ways of doing the same thing. And that's the question of the Chacham. His question is, Maha Eidos, why are there Eidos, which is literally testimony, our telling of the story, together with the Chukim and the Mishpatim? Because the Chukim and Mishpatim are the laws of the night. The laws of the night themselves should communicate the story behind them. So then the story should be redundant, and vice versa. It's a very interesting shaila. And what's the teretz? So the teretz is, I was not able to see the Brisker Rav's answer inside here. I'm lifting a little bit from a comment that we made in the name of Rav Cook a number of years ago. But the answer comes, Kehilchas HaPesach. We tell him it's like the halachas of Pesach. Like the halachas of Pesach. In other words, we're using the halachas of Pesach as a mashal. And what is the halacha that we tell him? Eimaftir nachar Pesach afikomen. We don't need anything after the Korban Pesach. And the question is, why? And well, we know why. We don't need anything after the Korban Pesach because we want the taste of the Korban Pesach to stay with you. Shisha Eir Tam Pesach Befiv. And that is true of the Seder night. That halacha is a perfect moshul for the Seder night. Because the Seder night should also be an evening to remember. An evening that will stay with us throughout the year. And therefore, we actually access the story in every possible way. We tell it, we hear it, we eat it, we drink it, until, in a sense, in every possible way, we're receiving and absorbing Yetzias Mitzrayim, because we don't wish to rely just on one medium. Because we want it to be like the Korban Pesach, that it should stay with us. And therefore, you tell the story, you have your Eidus. But there's plenty of halachas. And they also tell the story. But it's this, in a sense, it's like a surround sound type of story. But more than that, because it is ingested in every way. So it should be like the Korban Pesach and stay with us. That's why there's Eidus and also Chukin Memishpat. And let's conclude perhaps with the Ben Rasha. Now the Rasha, so his question is blunt and to the point. Ma ha'avoda hazos lachem. And as we know, he's very smart. He couldn't be too much of a Rasha if he wasn't smart. So he knows how to barb his words. Ma ha'avoda hazos lachem. What's this avoda like for you? Lachem means lachem v'lo lo. He's not interested for you and not for him. So we deal with him in kind. I mean, on a superficial level, you have to give him a tough answer. A tough question deserves a tough answer. What does Haki Yeshinov mean? That's another question. But we tell him, listen, actions have consequences. Bavuzeh osa Hashem li b'tzeisi b'mitzrayim. A person with this attitude wouldn't have been redeemed. Are you aware of that? Maybe you'd like to reconsider. Now, the interesting question that many Mefarshim ask is, how can we jump on the Rosha for saying Lachem? Ah, Lachem. You mean Lachem v'lo lo. You're not interested. Oh, you're a Rasha. Okay, let's go back to the Chacham. The Chacham said, Ma'edus v'chukim v'mishpatim asher tziv Hashem Elokeinu eschem. And we let it go. Give him a pass. Eschem. Where are the... Where's the ministry of grammar? Eschem. V'lo si. He's also a Rasha. Anyway, he gets extra points for the long words in the beginning. The Eidus in Chukim Mishpatim. How come Eschem didn't become Eschem V'lo Osi, but Lachem becomes Lachem V'lo Lo? It's a good shine. And the Vilna Gaon says, and actually in this, Rishonim have preceded him, the Machzor Vitri says the same thing. And there's a great deal in it. The difference between them is that the Chacham has understood that the mitzvahs are something that connect a person to the divine. Because when he asked his question, he mentioned HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name in the question. So Eschem now is much more benign, because especially if it's a child, maybe the parents heard it, he didn't hear yet. The Rasha, he's left HaKadosh Baruch Hu out of it. Ma havoda hazos lachem. That's it. And we say, by the way, about the Rasha, ulefisha hosiyas atzmo min haklal. He's taken himself out, says the Gaon. Kofar be'ikr means v'kofar be'ikr, meaning, and he's also taken HaKadosh Baruch Hu out of the equation, because it's just ma havoda hazos lachem. That's what divides the two. And in fact, the Mefarshim say, this is the remez. In the Pasuk in Koheles Perek Gimel, I believe, it says, V'ro'isi ani, she'esh yisron l'chocha min ha'sochal, ki yisron o'o min ha'choshech. I see the advantage of wisdom over folly, like the advantage of light over darkness. And what does that mean? It means, amongst other things, says the Gaon, that when light was created, it says, V'yikra elokim l'or yom l'choshech kara laila. Hashem called light day, and dark and cold night. And the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whose name is only attached to light and not to darkness. Vayikra Elokim la'or yom. V'lachoshech kara laila. It's pronouns. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu miyachad shemo. It doesn't associate in that way with darkness, with evil, only with light. And therefore, says the Koheles, I see this is really the difference between the Chacham and the Sachal, the one who made it and the one who didn't. It's exactly the same difference between light and darkness. One of them attached his name to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the other one didn't. And this, of course, is also an important part of the Seder night for us. And once again, we are reminded of there are those who, they go through the Seder, and they go through the procedure of the Seder. But it doesn't bring them any closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a procedure, and it's customs, and it's... But this, again, is the difference, as we've discussed many times, between Torah as a way of life and Torah as a lifestyle, whereby the difference is HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the center of the equation or not? So the message we get from the Chacham, if we can borrow from other sources, is to put the ale back into Yisrael. In other words, when we ask our questions and when we give our answers, it should be in order to connect us back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the original Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that should be have an emanation and reverberations this year and in the coming years. We'll leave it there this evening and pick up next week in Mitzvah Shem.